You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This episode is something that originally aired on a YouTube channel we do. If you'd like to get the latest videos before they come to the podcast form, please do consider heading over to YouTube and just plug in Biographics, spelt the same way that this podcast's name is spelt, and you will see all of our videos. They were designed for video first, but we just wanted to make them accessible to people in the podcast format. So please consider doing that. Also, if you'd like to leave us a review, a rating, wherever you get your podcasts, that would be amazing. It really does help us out. It gets this in front of more people, which is always a good thing. It really keeps us making it. I like reading the reviews. So there's that. And let's get into today's episode.
Edward I, known as Longshanks for his uncharacteristic height, was a man among men and a king among kings. As a child, he was so sickly that few thought he would survive to even take the crown. But take it, he did, immediately displaying a strength and determination that had been sorely lacking. He quickly established his authority with ruthless suppression of rebellion, earning him the nickname the Hammer of the Scots and the adoration of all of England. In this week's Biographics, we get up close and personal with the man who was Edward Longshanks, the King of England. Edward I, future King of England, was born at Westminster Palace in London on June 17, 1239. He was the first-born son of King Henry III and Eleanor of Provence. Henry was a great admirer of previous king, Edward the Confessor, and named his son in his honor. Edward was not a well child. In fact, he was so weak that the general consensus was that he wouldn't survive into adulthood. But survive he did, growing into an unusually tall and rather robust teenager. He would eventually grow to a height of 6'2", which allowed him to tower over most of his contemporaries. It was his unusual height which would lead soldiers to refer to him as Longshanks. During his formative years, Edward was groomed to take the mantle of king. He was educated by the best scholars and members of the clergy. He overcame his physical weaknesses to become an able wielder of the sword and club, as well as a keen student of the arts and languages. At the age of 15, Edward entered into an arranged marriage with a 13-year-old Eleanor, daughter of Ferdinand III of Castile. The union was precipitated by the fear of a Castilian invasion of the province of Gascony. As part of that marriage contract, Edward received land grants worth 15,000 marks annually in taxation. This land covered much of Ireland and Wales. However, the entitlement that the teenage prince had was only in name, as the lands were still controlled by his father and the income generated went not to him, but rather to the royal lieutenant, Simon de Montfort, the 6th Earl of Leicester. The Earl of Leicester was married to the king's sister. Edward did benefit from the marriage alliance on a more personal level. Unlike the vast majority of such arranged unions, he and Eleanor genuinely cared for each other, and that fondness grew into a love that lasted their entire lives. King Henry was an extremely pious man, whose main focus as king was on building up the authority and symbolism of the church. He devoted himself to rebuilding Westminster Abbey, putting his energies into this project at the expense of more pressing concerns of state. A series of ill-advised military forays, each of which ended in failure, added fuel to the fire of discontent with his reign among the nobility. Attempts were made to usurp the king's authority and wrestle power away from him. The two most powerful noble factions at that time were the Saleh and Cologne families, who were opposed to each other. Henry pushed a policy of neutrality between the camps. In 1255, however, the 16-year-old Edward began siding with the Saleh family. This marked his first act of independence from his father. In the following year, Edward began associating with what was called the Lusignan faction, made up of the half-brothers of his father, who were of French origin. This group was largely despised by the nobility and had a reputation for being rather uncouth and violent. Concerns were expressed in the royal court over the increasing wildness of Edward's conduct when he was with the Lusignans. 3 years later, a body of nobles drew up a document known as the Provisions of Oxford, which spelled out a series of reforms designed to give the barons much more say in the running of the king's government. The barons were especially opposed to the influence of the Lusignans. Relations between Henry and his brother-in-law Simon de Montfort had been strained from the very start. Simon had not sought the king's permission for marriage to his sister. Simon then proceeded to amass large debts, naming the king as guarantor, again without his permission. Simon was at the forefront of the barons' efforts to bring reform, and the pressure imposed eventually led to the king signing the provisions. He was now obligated to seek the counsel of his barons on matters relating to the governing of the kingdom. As the pressure began to mount on his father, Edward remained loyal to his friends, the Lusignans, and took a stance in opposition to the provisions of Oxford. But as the reform movement grew in intensity, his position shifted. On October 1259, he announced that he was supportive of the goals of the barons and aligned himself with his father's rival, Simon de Montfort. In November 1259, King Henry embarked on a voyage to France. In his absence, Edward's opposition to his father grew. He appointed several of the rebellious barons to important positions within the royal court. When news of this reached his father in Normandy, he was convinced that Edward was about to stage an overthrow. He quickly returned to London to reimpose his position. At first, the outraged Henry refused to even see Edward, but finally a sort of peace was brokered between them by the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was decided that Edward was to go abroad, which he did at the age of 21 in November 1260. He ended up in France, where he fell in love with his old pals, the Lusignans. Meanwhile, in 1261, King Henry, with the backing of the Pope in Rome, overthrew the provisions of Oxford. This led the barons to set up their own independent parliament. With civil war looming, this noble parliament was dissolved, and the noble rebellious barons fled. De Montfort himself left the country, but he returned 2 years later when the heat had died down. De Montfort managed to raise a sizable army and marched on London. The king vacillated and seemed ready to give up his throne. It was at this point that Edward stepped up and began to take control of the situation. Any hesitancy he had previously shown in supporting his father's rule had vanished, and he was now staunchly determined to restore the king's dominance. He took control of the king's army and led them in defense of the realm. The rebels were ousted from Windsor Castle. A compromise of sorts was reached thanks to the intervention of King Louis IX of France, who negotiated the agreement known as the Mise of Amiens. The peace between the king and the barons was short-lived. In 1264, hostilities broke out once more with the onset of what history recalls as the Second Barons' War. Once again, the barons were led by Simon de Montfort, while the forces loyal to the king were under the control of the now 24-year-old Prince Edward. In the wake of a series of smaller victories, Edward's army met up with the forces of de Montfort at the Battle of Luz on May 14, 1264. Things went well for the royalist forces as they managed to force the London contingent of the opposition into retreat. But then Edward made the mistake of breaking off with a portion of his army to chase down the Londoners. When he returned to the main scene of the battle, his forces had been defeated. Edward was taken as a prisoner and held until the following May, when he managed to escape. Over the next few months, the royalist forces steadily wore down the resistance army. The most telling victory was at the Battle of Evesham on August 4, 1265. The barons' army was ravaged, with many of its leaders being put to the sword. Simon de Montfort was himself killed when a lance was run through his body. Edward then allowed his soldiers to mutilate the body, including cutting off the testicles and hanging them over de Montfort's nose. Such actions were strictly against the protocol of war, which stipulated that nobles were to be treated humanely. However, Edward considered de Montfort to be a traitor, and therefore beyond the rules of conduct. The last of the rebels made a stand at Kenilworth Castle, finally surrendering in accordance with the terms of the Dictum of Kenilworth. Edward's decisive actions and leadership skills during the Barons' Rebellion showed him to be a man of action who possessed the courage, ability, and personality to be a great king. Yet, with the rebellion crushed and his father's rulership assured, he put his focus on an upcoming crusade. King Louis IX of France was planning a crusade to North Africa in order to defeat the Muslims. In 1268, Edward left England with a force of around 1,200 men. Along with him was his wife, Eleanor. After crossing the Channel and then the Mediterranean, they arrived at North Syria only to discover the French king was dead, the result of a fatal bout of dysentery. Edward was now the leader of the Allied force, and he chose to withdraw the fleet to Sicily. However, en route, a severe storm decimated the fleet, and the French contingent decided to return home. Rather than following the French example, Edward decided to forge ahead. He landed at Acre on May 9, 1271. The Christian Empire in the Holy Land was under serious threat from the Muslim states, with Jerusalem already having fallen in 1244. The Egyptian Mamluks were now threatening to take Acre, which served as the Christian capital. With a relatively small force of men, there was little Edward could do to stem the tide of Muslim aggression. The Mamluk warrior king, Baybars, had tens of thousands of men under his command. Before departing for home, however, Edward played a part in the negotiation of a truce with Baybars. Once the treaty was signed, he stayed for a period of time to ensure that its conditions would be carried out. One night, in September of 1272, an assassin entered the bedchamber of Edward and Eleanor in order to attempt to thrust a poisonous dagger into the prince's arm. Edward was able to fend off the attack and kill the assassin. Legend has it that Eleanor sucked the poison from her husband's arm, thus saving his life. In the wake of the foiled assassination plot, the royal couple, they left the Holy Land. Upon sailing to Sicily, Edward was given the news that his father, the king, had died. Edward had been weakened by the poison attack, and so now, as King of England, he and Eleanor, his queen, took a leisurely trip home. The situation back in England, it was pretty stable, so he didn't really see a need to rush back. Edward made his way home through Italy and then on to France, crossing the Channel in early August of 1274. Edward was officially crowned King Edward I on August 19, 1274 at Westminster Abbey. When the crown was placed upon his head, a chronicler reported that Edward immediately took it off again and stated that he would only wear it again when all of the territory that was lost during the kingship of his father was returned. The new king was 35 years old. He was tall, muscular, and militarily adept. He was the man of action that his father had simply not been. You see, he enjoyed the roughest and most dangerous forms of hunting, such as going after boars and wolves. As a younger man, he was prone to flying off the handle, but age had restrained his temper. By the time he ascended to the throne, he had built a reputation as a loyal friend and a devoted ruler. However, he was also known as a hard man who could be harsh, even cruel, in the furtherance of his own will. Edward's reign, it was not going to be a continuation of his father's weak and lenient rule. He immediately set about re-establishing the dominance of the crown. His love of power was unquestioned, but he saw that in order to retain power, he had to institute policies that were popular with the people. Determined to prevent a repeat of the civil war that had scarred his father's reign, he made lasting provision for the lower classes to be represented in Parliament. This established the basis of the House of Commons, which today is the predominant house in the English political system. During the first years of his reign, Edward focused primarily on streamlining and reforming the administration of his government. He then turned his attention to the situation that was occurring in Wales. The Prince of Wales, Llywelyn ap Gruffudd, had been handed the title by King Henry III in return for agreeing to pay homage to the English crown. Llywelyn, however, had been an ally of Henry and Edward's enemy, Simon de Montfort, and set about conquering other Welsh kingdoms, and was now threatening to move against England itself. Edward acted preemptively, leading a force of 10,000 across the Welsh border. However, Llywelyn's unpopularity at home prevented him from raising a sizable army to counter the English invasion. In fact, as his army moved up the Welsh countryside, Edward's forces were strengthened by the addition of local Welsh armies who were opposed to Llywelyn. Among those who joined Edward was Llywelyn's own brother, Dafydd. The upstart was soon deposed, and Edward claimed large swaths of Welsh territory as his own. He rewarded Dafydd by giving him a small parcel of land. That was not pleasing to him, and he felt that he deserved much more for his service to the crown. In 1282, Dafydd led a revolt against the king that was soon joined by his seething brother Llywelyn. An angry Edward responded by invading Wales a second time. This time, however, he was determined to go all out with a three-pronged attack from the south, east, and the north. The English invasion was unstoppable, resulting in the stomping out of the rebellion and the death in battle of Llywelyn. For his part, Dafydd was captured and executed. Edward consolidated his victory in Wales by constructing a series of castles throughout the land. The most impressive was at Carnarvon. It was here that Edward's son and future heir, Edward II, was born in 1284. The now vacant title of Prince of Wales was bestowed upon the child, and since that time, the heir to the British throne has been given that title in a ceremony that is held at Carnarvon Castle. When it came to foreign relations, Edward did his best to maintain peaceful relations with his European counterparts. Despite the fact that Philip III of France was his cousin, relations relations between the two powers were under constant tension. When Philip died in 1285, Edward crossed the Channel in order to pay homage to the new French king, Philip IV. He did not return to England until 1289, spending much time in the Duchy of Gascony, which was one of his possessions. In 1287, Edward took the cross for the second time, intending to stage another far more successful crusade to retake the Holy Land from the Muslims. He knew that success in this enterprise depended on the stitching together of a truly international European alliance. Towards that end, he expended much effort trying to preserve peace among the powers. Edward's long absence from London had thrown the government into confusion and chaos. He returned to discover that corruption was rife and was forced, in disgust, to expel many of his judges and ministers. On November 28, 1290, Eleanor died after suffering a protracted illness that may have been malaria. She was just 48 years of age, having spent 35 of them at Edward's side. The king was distraught at the loss of his wife. He became a hardened man in the wake of her loss, more bitter and brooding in nature. Edward's campaign against the Welsh had imposed huge financial burdens upon his nation. Taxes were the main way to meet those expenses, and a prime source of that taxation were the Jews of England. Edward taxed the Jews far more heavily than any other group. In 1279, he ordered the arrest of all the heads of Jewish households throughout the country. About 300 of them were put to death. The following year, all Jews were ordered to attend special sermons preached by Dominican friars in order to convert them to Christianity. Then, in 1290, Edward issued the Edict of Expulsion, by which all Jews were kicked out of England. It wasn't until 1656 that the Jewish ban in England was finally lifted. From 1290 onward, Edward's attention was focused on troubles in Scotland. Following the death of Alexander III in 1286, Scotland was governed in the name of his granddaughter, Margaret. King Edward had made the suggestion that his eldest surviving son, Edward of Carnarvon, and Margaret should be united in marriage, bringing about the union of England and Scotland. Before this could happen, though, Margaret died. The Scottish throne was now in dispute. With a number of claimants, the English king was asked to play the role of arbitrator, and Edward agreed, but on the condition that the claimants accept him as their overlord. In 1292, he awarded the throne to John Balliol, who was crowned as the new king. It didn't take long, however, for the Scottish people to resent the jurisdictional control that Edward held over their country. John was deprived of all his power, and the Scots formed an alliance with France. By this time, England's relations with the French had deteriorated. Things had come to a head when Philip IV refused to restore the Duchy of Gascony to Edward in 1293. Edward declared war on France at the very time that the Scots had united with Scotland. To make a bad situation worse, the Welsh chose this time to rise in rebellion. King John of Scotland gathered his forces in March of 1296. Edward mustered his forces and again marched into battle. Many Scottish nobles, including Robert the Bruce, sided with Edward, whose first target city was the city of Berwick. It turned into a brutal massacre of the Scots, with many people being killed. The next target was the castle at Dunbar. Despite having the higher grounds, the Scottish defenders were routed on April the 27th, 1296. The Scottish army was virtually wiped out, allowing Edward to quickly take a succession of castles. All that remained was for King John to surrender. On July the 2nd, John sent a pleading letter to Edward begging forgiveness and mercy. Edward accepted, but only after subjugating John to a series of humiliations, including having the Scottish coat of arms torn from his surcoat. He was then thrown into the Tower of London. But Edward wasn't finished with Scotland. He was determined to stamp out any vestiges of Scottish independence and to absorb its people into the English kingdom. He demanded oaths of fealty from all Scottish nobles and magnates. Any that refused to do so were hunted down as outlaws. After conquering the Scots, Edward returned south. He now had to focus on issues with the French. However, the masses in Scotland were not ready to subject themselves to the heel of Edward Longshanks. Resistance grew under three divergent leaders. In the southwest, Robert the Bruce emerged as the head of a gathering of nobles and church leaders. In the northeast, the struggle was spearheaded by Andrew Murray, and in the center of the country, forces were being gathered by an obscure member of a noble family named William Wallace. In 1297, Wallace murdered the English sheriff of Lanark, William de Heselrig. This act united the disjointed pockets of resistance into a full-blown rebellion. 2 months later, with the situation reaching a crisis point, Edward was forced to send his lieutenants in to deal with the situation. Meanwhile, he had his own battle to fight in Flanders, in France. Even though he didn't want his conquest of Scotland to unravel, he also knew that abandoning the planned French invasion would only strengthen the rebels' hand. As things turned out, the British underestimated the strength of the Scottish resistance. What appeared to be a Scottish attempt at a negotiated surrender was in fact a ruse to allow Wallace more time to gather his army. With his army strengthened, Wallace managed to push the English from Fife, Perthshire, and Dundee. The climactic battle occurred at Stirling Bridge. The English outnumbered the Scots 6-1, but when the leader of the first vanguard, Hugh de Cressingham, was reputedly struck down by Wallace himself, the thousands following turned and fled. Wallace went on to exploit the terrain and generally outmaneuver the British to win a resounding victory. Wallace quickly led his ever-growing forces to overthrow the remaining English outposts in Scotland. He then crossed the border and invaded English territory. After taking Northumberland, he reached as far south as Cockermouth. With this, it was time for Edward to take control of the situation personally. In 1298, the king's army gathered at Roxburgh, with the king joining them in early July. He marched north with 17,000 men. By now, Wallace had returned to Scotland. Edward was determined to hunt him down, though. Wallace, however, he was not keen to engage the king and drew the monarch further north. The Scots had stripped the lands, leaving the English with no food and a stretched out supply line. With his army disintegrating, Edward had a stroke of luck when intelligence was received that Wallace and his men were stationed at Falkirk, about 20 miles away. The king immediately set his army in the direction of Falkirk. The Scots, they were surprised, but they were in a strongly entrenched position. In the end, though, the strength of the English infantry and cavalry assaults was too much for the Scottish army, and they were torn to pieces. Wallace managed to escape and led pockets of resistance for the next 7 years. But the English, they were able to re-establish dominance over Scotland. In 1305, William Wallace was finally captured by the English. He was taken to London, where he was hung, drawn, and quartered. However, this wasn't the end of the Scottish problem for Edward. In 1306, Robert the Bruce assassinated a rival for the throne, which had been vacant for 10 years. He then had himself crowned King of Scotland. He was quickly defeated in battle with the English, after which he went into hiding, only to return in 1307 to conduct hit-and-run raids on English fortresses. Edward, now in failing health, was still determined to bring this latest Scottish rebel to heel. He again gathered his army and headed north. On the journey to Scotland, however, the king contracted dysentery. On the morning of July 7, 1307, he died just a few miles short of the Scottish border. It is said that he left instructions with his son for the flesh to be boiled from his body and his bones to be preserved. Then, every time the Scots should rebel against him, his son would carry with him the bones of his father. Instead, his body was taken back to London, where it was placed in a plain tomb in Westminster Abbey. 700 years later, that tomb is still on display, reminding visitors of the strength and authority of one of England's most impressive monarchs.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. Leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.